I'm Liz Joyner. On behalf of the Village Square Board of Directors and their families, I'd like to welcome you to American Dream Lost, More Inequality, Less Marriage, Failing Institutions, Forgotten Community. Tonight's program is made possible by the generous support of TRISECT, a strategy consulting team comprised of our own, cue up Steve Seibert, and his partners Glenda Hood and Shelley Lawton. You probably remember Glenda as Florida's Secretary of State and the Mayor of Orlando. Shelley's a nationally recognized leader and former head of the 7-County Collaborative Initiative in Central Florida, myregion.org. TRISECT sees policy as the result of the business, government, and civic sectors working together. We at Village Square particularly appreciate the concept of working together as well as their support of our programming. Thank you, Steve. This season's dinner theme, Astros Club, is one of the things that got created when John Hyde came and visited us last fall. He is the author of The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Religion and Politics. He's at NYU. And I also want to mention that if you're interested in this concept, you can actually go to asteroidsclub.org and you can host your own dinner party. The concept was hatched by John and Steve on a long drive from Alabama. And so we brought Steve here to make an introduction to you.
Well, good evening. So the author William Isaacs writes about how Americans actually converse with each other, and he said, "Americans communicate by debate, not by dialogue. We see our conversations as arenas in which to win points. People do not listen, they reload." And are we seeing that? Can we name a place where that might be happening right now? John Hyde, that Liz mentioned, came here to Tallahassee, and something was in his mind, and I had the great opportunity to just pick him up in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and the two of us are driving, and he said, "I've got something I'm thinking about," and it's the Asteroids Club. And his concept was this, and we're the test case in the country, and he supported us trying to figure out whether this idea would work. He said, "You know, we all try to find common ground." He said, "Common ground doesn't always work very well, or maybe it doesn't work very well at all, but common threats do. So if we look up in the sky and we see an asteroid coming toward our planet, we all suddenly get focused on that and say, how do we solve this problem? And maybe we get kind of, you know, working together at it." And he said, "That's true, but here's our problem. We all see different asteroids. If you're sort of on the right, you look up," and I'm going to overgeneralize this, just bear with me. "If you're on the right, you may look up and say, debt is a real problem we need to focus on. And that really, and that is my asteroid. And I'm looking up going, look at that debt, it's coming at us. And perhaps my more liberal friend is saying, yeah, that's really not the problem. The real problem is income inequality, and we've got to deal with that." And the person on the right's going, "Yeah, maybe not. That's not what's moving me." And so John started to think through what these things are. Sort of the destruction or the diminution of the family, a huge issue on the right. How does that resonate maybe on the left? Climate change. You know, you have a whole group on the right that don't even recognize it's happening, and perhaps on the left they're saying, how can you be so obtuse not to see what's happening? So the point would be, maybe these people, us, could actually take a few moments and listen to the passion of the other side, would suspend our judgment for a little while to hear what the asteroid is from the other side, and the deal is this, then you've got to listen to mine. That's the deal. And maybe in the course of that dialogue, some understanding occurs. Maybe there is common ground through common threats. That's the theory of the Asteroid Club. This is kind of hard to grasp, right, Steve? I mean, he was right there at the beginning, Bill Maddox. We all tried to understand how this might work. We don't know if it will. This is the test case. We don't know in all of America whether people will actually sit for long enough to listen to the other side, not in a debate format, but in a listening format, and in a humble, in a probably a good place to be talking, with a certain amount of moral humility to listen to the other side. That's what this is about. That's what this program, these programs over the course of this year are about. So I'll just cue it up and then be quiet. That's our asteroid. Let's go to the next one. So, and you're going to be hearing and seeing these figures. It's pretty straightforward. These numbers are dramatic. And when you start looking at the kinds of numbers on all of these asteroids, you start to see this movement up. So rising inequality, the numbers are staggering. Next slide. And who said that? Interesting. All right. Perhaps on the other side, a discussion we don't typically have. Rising non-marital births. It's starting, you know, it's the same hook that we just saw on the last slide. And might there be some connection between these two slides? And are we mature enough to talk about it? Go ahead. Next slide. You get the point. Go ahead, next slide. So again, you're starting to look at these. And by the way, if you looked at climate change, you'd see the same thing. If you looked at debt, you'd see the same thing. Go ahead. And then you actually are starting to get some newspaper reviews saying, you know, let's look behind. Let's look at the facts here and see what's actually happening in this country. I think that's about. So tonight isn't a debate. This is how we converse. Let's stop it for a little while and move on. So with that, I think that's my last slide, isn't it? Yes, it is. There is our very fancy, expensive logo that we have on the answer. And, you know, it was really fun. You know, sometimes you think that maybe we have these conversations and nobody's listening and maybe it really doesn't matter. There was one guy that was actually pretty charmed by the nature of the conversation that we were having here in Tallahassee. And it was John Haidt, who's probably like the smartest guy on the planet, you know? And we go over to Steve's, to the university. He's got 400, right? So it was 400 students all came out. After John spoke here, he went over to FSU. 400 students sat and had this conversation about moral humility, actually. So with that, Bill Maddox, there he is. Bill, a board member as well, who will be facilitating tonight's conversation.
All right, got it. Okay, so when this discussion first arose in some of our board meetings about doing a first event that would be centered around the asteroids of income inequality and family breakdown, Liz said, well, does anyone know anyone who's an expert on either of these topics? And I said, well, gosh, you know, I happen to know someone who's an expert on both. And we have the privilege tonight of hearing from Kay Heimowitz. I'm going to have Kay come and join us. Kay is affiliated with the Manhattan Institute. She lives in Brooklyn, is the married mom of three adult children. So that really is her source of expertise more than anything else. But she has written for many years about these topics, especially for the City Journal, which is a publication that if you're not familiar with, I would commend to you highly. Very interesting publication put out by the Manhattan Institute. And she wrote several years ago a book that will be kind of the basis for our discussion tonight called Marriage and Caste in America. And so what I want to do, grab your mic, Kay, and what I'm going to do is spend a few minutes asking a few kind of foundational questions of Kay. We're then going to have someone from FSU come and speak to contribute further to the conversation. And then we're going to hear from a local policymaker and a local nonprofit organization head to further our discussion as we go. Throughout the evening, we're going to have some opportunity for you to get involved in the discussion, asking questions. But I think we're going to have a really exciting and interesting conversation. So what I want to do really at the outset here, Kay, is just to say, give us a sense of your thesis. And what I'm particularly interested in, because this jumped out at me when I first saw your book, is the use of the word caste, not a common word in this culture, and I'm curious to know why you used it and why you think it's illustrative of the problem that you're describing.
Okay. Maybe the best way for me to start is to describe a little bit how I got interested in this topic. I was doing a lot of work for the Manhattan Institute, where I'm a senior fellow, as Bill mentioned, and looking a lot into children, the child outcomes, how are kids doing. There was an increasing amount of research suggesting that children who were growing up either with divorced parents or increasingly, this was in the early 90s, mothers who had never been married at all, were not doing as well on a lot of measures. They were more likely to be to grow up in poverty. They were less likely to do well in school if they graduated from high school. They were less likely to go to college. If they did go to college, they were less likely to complete college. They were less likely to go to an elite college. One of the most striking things I ran into was a research by a professor at Cornell University who said that she was a sociologist, and she was very struck by looking around her classrooms and finding that almost all of her students came from intact married families. And this was at a time where it seemed like every family was falling apart. So there were some things that didn't make a lot of sense, and I stumbled across an article by two Harvard professors well known in the field who wrote a research piece called "The Unequal Spread of Single Parent Families." And bingo, I suddenly found something that made so much sense and has really informed my work and will inform a lot of the discussion here tonight. That is that actually the breakdown of the family, and by that I'm referring to the rise in divorce that took place throughout the 70s, 80s, it reached its height in the around 1980, and the rise of unmarried motherhood is disproportionately affecting low-income, less-educated men and women. Actually, the number or the percentage of women who are college-educated, who have children outside of marriage, is very, very small. Probably around 6%. Divorce also, though it rose in the 70s into about 1980, it stabilized for quite a bit after that and then declined. I always joke at this point when I'm talking about this stuff that I seem to be related to a large number of those people who, college-educated people who did divorce, but nevertheless, we can't go by anecdotes. We're going by the big, big numbers here. So it began to occur to me that if this family breakdown was disproportionately affecting less educated, lower income people, that meant that those people were going to have less possibilities for the future. In other words, the children of those families were less likely to go to college, to graduate high school, number one, but then to go to college, to graduate college, and so on and so forth. In other words, not only was there this discrepancy by income in terms of the families that children were growing up in, but that the outcomes themselves were going to be reinforced by the family situation that they found themselves in. And that leads me to the question you ask. Why did I use the word caste? It's interesting, a lot of times when I've talked about this book, I have people referring to it as marriage and caste in America. And I wonder whether they think I'm talking about chastity or something. I'm not sure. But it's marriage and caste. Caste is actually, I deliberately chose the term as a kind of provocation because it's a term that you usually use for very traditional societies where there's absolutely no mobility between classes. You are born into a caste, into a, it's not just a class, but a highly defined caste where you stay, and your children stay, and your children's children stay, and so on and so forth. And the point I wanted to make was that with the family breakdown disproportionately affecting lower income and less educated people, we are creating a caste society that allows for very little mobility. Now, if I can just clarify one thing, the chart we looked at before showed you that amazing, I think it was a red line with the top 1% that was the most notable. I don't know that what I'm describing here speaks to that issue very much. So the more compelling piece for me, and I think this is true for a lot of people in political science and sociology, is the issue of mobility. Because if you have inequality, it's one thing. But when you have a situation where people are stuck and cannot move, then we've got the real loss of an American dream.
Okay. I want to go somewhere just for a minute and then return to kind of root causes. And the place I want to go is this. You're describing problems, and particularly problems at the bottom end. But if I'm understanding you correctly, part of this income inequality and part of this divergence that you see between upper and lower caste, if you will, is also because of something going on at the top end. Explain that for us.
That's right. So if on the one hand, less educated, lower income people are having their children often outside of marriage and disproportionately divorcing when they are married, those children are having less good outcomes than children who are growing up in intact families. Well, on the other hand, amazingly, and again, this is counterintuitive perhaps for some of you here who are college educated, amazingly, those children of college-educated families are far more likely to grow up in stable two-parent families, to get all of the benefits of their accrued wealth, because that's part of what happens in marriage, is that you join incomes, especially these days, among educated women who are going into the workforce in great numbers, as you know, and earning quite a bit of money. You then have these joint bank accounts where the parents are able to not just put a lot of financial resources behind their kids' education and development, but also a great deal of educational know-how. That is, they've been to college. They know what's required. They know the kinds of extracurriculars and college essays and all of that stuff that is so much part of upper middle class and upper middle class childhood today. So on the one hand, you have what some people are now beginning to call a glass floor. That is where people at the top, and by the top I'm referring not to that magical 1%, but to at least the upper 10% and probably down into the 20-30%, who are in a fairly good position to pass on their advantages to their children, and whose children will likely stay in more or less the same quintile. That's generally the way it's described. And on the other hand, you have the others who cannot climb up. So both those things are going on.
So whereas a generation ago, a doctor may have married
Yes.
a homemaker and they may have enjoyed a good living, today a doctor may marry a fellow doctor and they would enjoy, economically speaking, a great life and would be able to pass on to their children all sorts of insight into how to get ahead
Right.
in life that puts their children at a significant advantage over those that are coming out of these broken families that
Right.
you're describing.
Right, and that you put it much better than I did. Let me clarify, though, and I think you undoubtedly know this, this is not just an economic thing. The children of educated parents benefit not just from the income those parents are able to bring in, but also, as I said before, their know-how. They have certain kinds of skills.
Hang on just one second, because I want to interrupt you here and note that in this book, there is a very provocative chapter entitled The Missionary Position, which...
It's not what you think.
Which is not what you think, but provocative nevertheless. And I think where you're headed is
exactly
into that chapter. So please help us understand what you describe as the mission that parents in this generation or in this modern age have, and please contrast it with what parents of a agricultural society of bygone era might have experienced.
Okay. So I won't take you through the whole history of the bourgeois family, but basically the rise of this sort of nuclear family, this very closely knit husband and wife unit with the kids that developed through the 18th, 19th century, maybe even back to the 17th, depending on where you want to start, were very, very child-centered from the beginning. The idea was you put a lot of energy, a lot of affection, and a lot of focus on your child, on their individuality, on developing them. And one sociologist that I read and who I was deeply influenced by, Brigitte Berger, calls this this was the mission of the nuclear family. And that continues to be the mission of the educated class. And then some. I mean, you know, we can all make a lot of jokes about the excesses of the helicopter parents out there. I remember when I first started talking about this, speaking to a dean at the college where my daughter went and telling him about my work, and he said, "Oh, yes, we call the worst of those parents Black Hawks." There are a lot of jokes about them, but you know the truth is there is a great deal of attention needed, and it's an extremely complex and competitive economy and society out there. And organizing your kids, developing your kids for that society takes a fair degree of focus. Now, there's a significant amount of research showing that there's a great deal of class difference when it comes to raising kids, and when it comes to this focus on the mission. Very famous work, very widely quoted work, I should say, by a sociologist at Temple University in Philadelphia, Annette Leroux, culminated in a book called Unequal Childhoods. She carefully studied a number of families, lower income, more educated, as well as more educated. And what she found was that, she didn't use these terms, but yes, the more educated family used this mission idea that the child was, you know, this was their mission as a couple to develop this child. Whereas she found among her less educated subjects much more of a sense that the child would sort of take care of, you know, would grow and in a more organic sense, would just kind of develop, didn't need that kind of careful, you know, hothouse nurturing that middle class and upper middle class parents were prepared to give their kids. So there is a difference in class in the orientation towards the next generation, which is something we also probably will need to bring into this conversation.
But I think, as someone who would probably be accused rightly of being a helicopter father, I was actually heartened by your argument that in this day and age, parenting requires a certain amount of preparing your children for a different economy than might have existed in my grandparents' age or great-grandparents' age when everybody was on the farm and stayed on the farm.
That's right. Look, kids who are growing up with any kind of real opportunities in life, kids particularly of middle and upper middle class parents, are facing an economy where they are going to have to figure out what they want to do. I don't talk about this in Marriage and Caste, but in a more recent book that I wrote called Manning Up, I describe what it's like for a young college student today to be thinking about their future. What do I want to do? Well, there are all these careers out there that didn't exist 10 years ago. What, 5 years ago? And maybe even 2 years ago. These kids have to be really well prepared. They have to have a lot of skills to know how to negotiate all that. There's a lot of people skills, social skills. There's a lot of complex, abstract thinking about all of these things. So I'm somewhat sympathetic to helicoptering. Like everybody else, love to make fun of it too and see the excesses, but you can feel better.
Okay. I feel much better, and I will feel even better when I'm joined here on the stage by our next guest. So I want her to come forward now. This is Kathy Tillman. Kathy is an associate professor of sociology here at Florida State University. She did her graduate work, PhD work, at the University of North Carolina, which, as many of you know, is Liz Joyner's alma mater. So Liz now wants us all to stand and to sing the UNC fight song. We probably won't do that. But I do want, Kathy herself brings to the table expertise, I think, across the board on both of these topics. So here's the question I want you to help us with, and that is, you've heard Kay, you've read her work. Give us a sense of what you think people on the left most need to take away from what Kay is saying, and likewise, what one thing you would say people on the right need to be sure they hear either about what Kay has said or what you think on this topic generally before they leave tonight. You can take either one of those you want first.
Okay, thank you. I think a lot of the message that you're putting out in your argument here needs to be heard by the left, honestly. I think the research is very clear that family matters. You know, family context matters for children, and the kind of family that you grow up in matters. There are wonderful families of all different types that are very successful at raising children, but the trends suggest that on average, certain kinds of families are better able to support and raise their children, to have successful outcomes in the ways that we often typically measure success, academics, health, emotional well-being, all of those things. And so that's very real. And we do know that we have real differences by social class in terms of a variety of family-related behaviors, whether it's marriage or divorce or childbearing outside of marriage or age at marriage, all of these kinds of things. So that is very real.
All right, let me jump in real quick and make sure I hear you correctly. The reason that the left, you think, particularly needs to hear this is because when you said there's certain family forms or certain family contexts that are better or lead to better outcomes for children than others, that's an idea that many on the left would be slow to admit. Is that fair?
I think it's a difficult idea for some.
Because at this point, but one who says this is making judgments.
It can feel that way, I think, sometimes.
And it could be accused, as I suspect you probably have been, of moralizing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But your argument is, and make sure I'm not putting words in either of your mouths, that you're saying this is just the data. The factual data show these sorts of forms lead more often to these positive outcomes than others.
Data shows that, clearly.
Okay.
And some of my own work shows
that. All right,
that.
Rail on the right for us.
I'm not going to say I'm going to rail on the right.
Give helpful advice to our conservative friends.
There are a couple of things that I hope that we'll talk a little bit about tonight. And one of them is that a lot of the trends that we're talking about, we've been talking largely in the context of the United States, which is what most of us know. But a lot of the things that have changed about families have been changing in countries around the industrialized world. So if you talk about age at marriage, or you talk about the rise of cohabitation in place of marriage, or non-marital childbearing, or all of these kinds of trends, we're seeing very similar patterns of change in much of the industrialized world, in much of Europe, and even in parts of Asia at this point. So this is not a uniquely American phenomenon. Now, some of the outcomes associated with it, exactly how things play out, can be unique from country to country. And so it's really important to think about issues like income inequality and how that interplays with changes in the family in terms of child outcomes. And we can come back to this issue in more depth. But the second thing that I think is really important is to talk about kind of fundamental causes. So we know that there have been these big shifts in how we live our family life. And I think the two sides, if you should say sides, often take slightly different approaches to understanding why those changes started happening. Like, what started happening that led us in this direction? And the right tends to focus more on cultural change, that people started having different values and different ideas about what's appropriate behavior, and having greater tolerance for a variety of family forms. And folks on the left tend to focus more on economic change and economic processes at a larger level. And I would argue the fact that these trends are not happening just in the U.S., but are happening in a variety of places that often have different cultural backgrounds than our own, suggests that changes in economic modes of production in general are really important. That as we see economies develop economically, and move towards industrialization and then beyond that into what we are now, kind of a technological kind of society, we inevitably are going to see some changes in the way people think about themselves and their world and their place in it and their role in it. And that's going to influence family behaviors.
Okay, fair enough. So what I'd like to hear both of you speak to is this question of root causes, and I'm particularly interested in this. I noticed, Kay, that you devoted an entire chapter in your book to problems within the black family or the black community, and I know that we don't want to dwell there or to go there and insinuate in any way that this is a problem limited to that population, but I'm curious to know whether you guys would say that how much of the problem as you see it is attributable to cultural factors, how much is attributable to economic factors, irrespective of cultural shifts in cultural values, and I'm particularly interested in whether the root causes might be different in black and white communities, potentially.
Right. Before I get to that, let me just make one remark about Kathy's comments. There's no question that a lot of the changes that are happening in the United States are happening in the other parts of the developed world. What's different in the United States is the instability of family life. In other words, it is true that in, let's say, to pick a common contrast, Sweden, it's true that there's a lot of childbearing outside of marriage. However, the relationships appear to be a de facto marriage. In other words, couples stay together. They're cohabiting at the time of the birth, and they stay together. That's not the case in the United States. Children who are born to cohabiting parents here are likely to see their parents break up, or are three times as likely to see their parents break up by the time they're 5 years old as the children of married parents. There's much more instability in our non-marital relationships than there is in other parts of the world. Now, to get to the race issue, the whole question of family breakdown really came to the attention of the public and of policymakers around 1965, when Daniel Patrick Moynihan wrote a very famous report where he noticed that there had been an increase in the number of non-marital births among blacks, mostly in the inner city. And he became very alarmed at this because he himself had grown up in the Irish ghetto of New York City and seen a lot of fathers disappear, and felt that it had created great, great problems for the community there. So he wrote this report. Now, at the time, and as I said, he was writing about the black community. At the time, the out-of-wedlock birth rate was about 24%. And today, the black out-of-wedlock birth rate is 72%. So that's, you know, just clarify, that means that 72% of all black children are born to unmarried mothers. Now, that, however, can mislead us to think that this is a black problem. It is not. Since the time that Moynihan wrote his report, there's been a steady increase in the percentage of white women, particularly white working class women, who are having children outside of marriage, and there are and who are more in more fragile marriages, more likely to divorce, and with the growth of the Hispanic population, we've also seen a rise there as well, so that about half of all Hispanic children are born to unmarried mothers as well. So this goes across the board, and we are now among white Americans about where, or well, actually further along from where Moynihan was raising the alarm about black children. So this is no longer just a racially unique problem at all.
You want to say anything on this?
Yeah, I would also like to add that, you know, you asked how much of this do you think is culture, how much do you think is economic? And I would say, and this is going to be shocking for a liberal, it's both. Okay. but I would argue that the economic comes before the culture. That said, the culture becomes important in and of itself as well. And I think it's not just a particular subgroup's culture that we're talking about either. So again, it's not a black population issue or a white population issue, but rather it's the culture of everyone that's shifted. And so as I'm actually a social demographer as well as a sociologist, and so we do tend to look at the big picture of macro change around the world. And some of those theories about what's been going on suggest that as we develop economically, as we get further and further away from subsistence level living, from living on the edge, populations ranging from us to Sweden to France to Japan, all over the place, have seen a move away from that traditional from the traditional extended family kind of unit. That as we become more secure, we've been able to grow in our sense of individual autonomy. I can go out as our economy has developed and we have wage-paid labor. We don't have to work on the farm anymore. We don't have to stick around with mom and dad. We can make our own decisions. People started gaining control over their own lives more. Okay, so we've seen a rise in individualism in general as a cultural trait. And particularly in America, we've seen this serious rise in individualism over time if we take a very long historical look. And that's not something that started in the 60s. You know, and you can see that the track, if you track that along with family change, what that's meant is as people have gained more power over their own lives, have had to report back to the families less, they've delayed marriage more. They've chosen their own mates instead of letting their parents choose them. And as we've gotten more and more individualized, we've started putting our own goals ahead of family formation. So today we see across the board people saying, well, you should have your education taken care of. You should have your financial stability in line before you get married, before you have a family. Wealthy people, middle-class people, that's the common idea now. That's not what it used to be. So this is everybody cultural change that's led to kind of more variability and more tolerance for doing things your own way. But the issue is the economy did start changing in the 1960s, 1970s, 1980s in ways that made it harder for some people to meet all those self-fulfilling goals first. So the wealthy and the middle class, they want to become financially stable and do all those things before they have a family. Well, the kinds of jobs that are available now they're still able to meet those goals for the most part. They can go to college. They can get their degree. They can still form a family. Those on the bottom end, those who face that downside of economic inequality, are finding it increasingly hard to feel like they've met those financial goals, to feel like they've met those kind of self-fulfilling things first. And so they delay marriage, and they delay marriage, and they delay marriage. And those kinds of issues have hit the poor hard, and disproportionately, we know that our poor is made up of racial minorities as well, so we get that kind of convergence of race and class.
I want to pick up on something that you said there, that where you talked about a progression or a sequencing of different life choices, and the question that I'd really like to see both of you respond to is this question of life scripts that you referred to in your book, and it reminded me of an old playground chant that my sister, who's here, probably remembers that we often heard when we were growing up, which was, you know, Johnny and Betty sitting in a tree, K-I-S-S-I-N-G. First comes love, then comes marriage, then comes Betty with the baby carriage. So there was a very prescribed script to how one should make these kind of life choices. And so I'm curious to know whether, what I think I hear you saying is, we kind of abandon any sense of script and any sense that there's a right order of things, and that has ultimately led to, more often than not, negative outcomes on the part of young people. So my question is that true? And then is the answer, for both of you to respond to, is the answer the recreation of some life script that might guide young people?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a curious fact that the scripts are gone. As Cassie described it very accurately, I think, we are much more individualistic about our choices. Many young women and men will decide not to get married, or they may decide to get married and not have children. And those scripts, the expectation that first you do this and then you do that, and everybody does it, that is gone. For better or worse. And the problem, or the odd consequence of this, though, is that among college-educated men and women, the script still, the old-fashioned script, still dominates. Young people, they fall, you know, they're much later than they used to, no question about it, because largely because women are needing to develop their careers and establish themselves before they marry. But they marry first, and they hopefully fall in love first, they marry, and then they have their children. That is not what's happening among less educated folks. And what's very curious is that even though the average age or median age of marriage now has gone up for every class for every education group to be about 27 for women and 29 for men, less educated women are still having their babies at around 23 or 24. So the script is gone for them, but not for highly educated folks.
Well, I would argue, though, that the values and the ideals and the dreams that people have often aren't very different. There's been some really good qualitative work where sociologists have gone in and interviewed and talked to people about what do you really want and why have you made the choices you've made. And what we find is that whether it's a middle class or a higher income woman or it's a poor woman, most women are saying, I want to fall in love. I want a soulmate, and that's another new development that didn't used to be. We have to be romantically like falling in love with this person all the time now, which is hard to sustain over a life course. But all women will say, I want this romantic, passionate relationship. I want marriage. And most of them will say, ideally, I want that marriage before I want children. Poor women are just as likely as wealthy women to say, I know that marriage is a good thing for kids. Kids do better when families are married. I think the difference is that there's more disjuncture between the ideals and the desires of the poor and their behavior than there is for the wealthy. And I would argue that much of that comes from the sense of blocked opportunity, that they have these desires and these ideals, that they know marriage is a good thing, particularly in our society where marriage is linked to a whole host of resources. They want fathers in their children's lives. They want all of these other things. But given our now strong cultural ideal that you, first of all, must be in love, you must have a suitable, lovable partner who's wonderful, and that you should become an adult in other ways before you get married, and an adult now means I'm done with my education, I've got a good job, a lot of these women feel like that's never going to happen. If I'm struggling, if I'm making a low-wage income every day and I don't see that changing anytime soon, if I don't see myself going to college, I'm never going to be financially stable. I'm never going to feel solid. I'm never going to own a house. I'm never going to have all these things that are now kind of the benchmarks for being ready to get married. And everybody shares those benchmarks when you take these surveys now. And so I think they're going ahead and doing these other behaviors like having children, because they're not ready for the marriage yet, but they don't necessarily want to forego the children. If I'm never going to be married, ready for marriage, am I never going to have kids? Yeah, and most Americans say they want children, and mm-hmm. fundamentally they're willing to do that without marriage, if it means without marriage.
All right, these ladies have given us an awful lot to think about, and we're going to take a pause in just a second and ask you if you've got any questions of them before we invite our next guest up. But before we do, I want to ask Kay to respond to this soulmate reference. And in three words or less, tell us, are you in agreement that there's a real problem with this soulmate view of marriage, or is that not a problem?
It's a problem.
Three words. Okay, in just a minute, I'm going to bring up two other guests whom I hope will join me in expressing at least some appreciation for a romantic view of marriage. But before we get there, do any of you have any questions of either of our guests? Yes.
10 years from now, 15 years from now, we've seen these data points. They're pretty striking. We're at 70% in the African American community. We're at 60% in the Hispanic, or we're, you know, whatever. What does America look like 15 years from now? Is everybody at 70%? And if that's the case, what does that mean?
It's a very hard thing to call. So if we're following the trends, if we just look at the trend lines, we would say there will be a very slight increase among college-educated women non-marital births, but only very slight. And there will be and continue to be an increase among less educated folks towards non-marital births. This gets us into politics of a sort that I'm not sure how useful this is right now, but I'll just throw it out there not to create any problems. But one result of this is the need for more state support, the need for a stronger welfare state to support unmarried mothers. That depending on where you're sitting or standing or thinking, it could be a problem. So you might want to think about that aspect of it too. Aside from the inequality issue, there's also the amount of the question of where the support for fatherless children comes from.
We have another question here.
Hold on, you need a mic. You're on the radio.
So I want to follow up on that question. Let's go 25 years from now, when the minority population is 50% of the United States. And you talked about the asteroid theory. So now put it in context as to what this could mean data-wise 25 years from now, when those population groups make up the majority and increasing because they're probably having more children.
Okay.
And low income. So I looked at all three. It's Black, Latino, and low income when I looked at the birth rates.
Okay. Well, I was going to say, I think a lot of that ties back into the education income issue. You know, that much of what's going on is very much just related to social class, more so than race in and of itself. You know, so as the minority populations grow, if levels of higher education among those groups grows as well, you're going to see a slowing down of some of that trend. But if it does not, then you may have a very unfortunate situation where a very quickly growing portion of our population is also experiencing, you know, these kinds of family trends as well, which could be very dramatic in terms of family support.
I would add one thing. On the economic front, there's every reason to believe that the demands for, or rather the benefits to higher education are going to continue to be very, very high. And the more that the children of already educated are going to need more and more support to take advantage of those benefits, the more disparate the outcomes, I think. You know, we're seeing a real, we didn't actually get into this talking about inequality, but there's another trend, which is kind of the hollowing out of the middle, where middle-income jobs are disappearing. And I've seen some pretty scary scenarios about what might happen along those lines. And either the kids of that group are going to fall lower, or they're going to go to school and get their graduate degrees and really climb even further up. So there's some big questions in the long run that are related to the family breakdown issue and the economic piece of this as well.
All right. So if you've got questions, we'll have opportunity for you to ask others. What I want to do now is to invite, since the policy question has been introduced into our discussion, I want to invite up now our two additional panelists. We have joining us tonight Andrew Gillum, who many of you know is a city commissioner here in Tallahassee, former student body president at Florida A&M, and I understand a candidate for mayor. And I also want to invite up Richard Albertson. Richard is a former official at the executive agency level in Washington who has some policy experience. But his primary contribution tonight very likely could very well be about his current work as the president and CEO of Live the Life, which is a nonprofit organization here in Tallahassee that devotes a lot of its energy toward addressing many of these problems of family breakdown and income inequality in its work. So I guess please join me in welcoming Andrew and Richard to our discussion. And I guess what I'd like to invite either or both of you to do at this point is just to comment on anything that you may have heard that you'd like to amplify or offer additional input on.
Well, thank you all for having us, and it's been nice sitting out there looking in your living room to see how this conversation takes place. You know, I had a number of reactions, I have to tell you. When the two of you were discussing sort of the helicopter parent, and I started thinking back on my own environment and growing up and really what that meant, and it dawned on me what a luxury it is for some people to have a helicopter parent situation. The number, and this is where it comes into, I think, public policy, because oftentimes we sort of brush an entire population of people, whether it be economic, race, background, or educational background, or otherwise, with a broad brush. And, you know, I think about my mom, who I remember helping her prepare her taxes. I went home for my freshman year of college, and she worked two jobs, one as a bus driver and one as a dry cleaner. And one of her stubs, her W-4s, had $22,000. That was her primary job. And the other one had a total of $6,000. Again, we grew up in a house, seven kids. And my mother graduated high school, wanted the absolute best for us. But really didn't, one, have the time to interact, I think, with our educational upbringing, the way that I think if she had her full druthers and her full comfort and sort of came from a background that would have made it more comfortable for her to interface with us there. Thank goodness my story worked out and we're doing okay. And where public policy comes in, I think, is so often we sort of limit this conversation to really simple platitudes, wherein we talk about a child's outcome, educational outcome, but yet the debate neglects all the inputs that are required to create an opportunity to learn for a child. And it starts with Maslow's hierarchy of needs, of shelter, of food, of security, of safety. And if that doesn't exist there, then what are we introducing our children into? And so it is not enough to then just call out the need for stronger families or even just the economic inequality divide. You actually have to be thoughtful about public policy in the sense that you start to speak to the symptoms, that not just to the symptoms, but to the problems that belie the symptoms. And I think our political system does not incentivize thoughtful public policy making that starts to create public policy solutions that speak to the root problem. Rather, we incentivize really quick talking points, really quick black and white. It's either good or it's either bad. It's either poor or not. And that is what our system has created. I think a lot of public policy solutions that are not solutions at all.
I really appreciate your contribution there. And I want us to go to some of these intersections and some of these places that we don't always go in our policy discussions. But before we do, Richard, is there anything we've missed so far, any gaps you see in our discussion that you need to fill, or perhaps a point that was just so profound you want to echo it?
Well, I just wanted to pick up on the conversation, the idea of the sequence of success that some of the scholars have talked about, which is first comes love, then comes marriage, that the research is pretty strong that young people who follow that sequence of success, which is, you know, get your education, don't get married when you're a teenager, and don't have sex until you get married. If you do those three things, the research is overwhelming that those young people have better outcomes in life.
Don't have children till you get married.
I'm sorry?
Don't have children till you get married.
I'm sorry. Yeah, don't have children until they get married. Thank you. So that's, to me, the sequence of success is very important, and that's something that we should be able to say as a society that is a roadmap. That is a roadmap to success, and I hope we can say that. This is a roadmap, and secondly, that marriage matters, you know, that we are for healthy marriage. This is a reliable roadmap to have a successful outcome in life.
Okay, so you're saying this as someone who's the head of an organization that would be part of the faith community, and yet I hear you drawing not on faith or sacred writings alone in making a case for some sort of script, but suggesting that it's actually confirmed by the data that Kay and others have collected.
Yeah, the research. And also with regard to poverty, the folks that are the academics can speak to this more than I can, but I remember seeing research that said one of the top drivers of poverty was women who are getting divorced who are going to the county office to get TANF and to get assistance because their husbands left them, and now that's a major driver. I think I saw one report said 50% of new welfare benefits are from people getting divorced. So if we can do something to prevent divorce and have healthier marriages, I think we would affect the poverty just right there. But
interesting.
Okay. I'd be interested in knowing how the data, so as we are, I think, updating the conversation to reflect present day realities, different folks define marriage differently, healthy partnerships, healthy relationships, and I don't think there's any one of us that would be against promoting healthy marriages, healthy partnerships, healthy relationships. But if there is going to be a new normal, I'm curious to know, how is it that we not, so if folks are not, again, as you all have already pointed out, not getting married in traditional marriages, as has your research has shown as being a big indicator for their child's success and family success, how do we adjust to the new normal that may be created by that? Because I think the worst outcome could be to say we're all doomed to hell, because the trend lines are moving in one direction. But how do we update the scenario that our new normal on the outlook on the future years are brighter, even if folks choose not to get married?
Well, Couple of responses to that. One is that we've tried an awful lot of public policies to compensate for children's disadvantage of all sorts. We've had reading programs and parenting programs and preschool programs and Head Start programs and not to mention, you know, a lot of benefits and that, you know, cash benefits and cash support. And I'm not speaking against any one of those except to say we don't have any evidence that those programs will equalize outcomes. If we're really concerned about inequality, and that was certainly the reason that I wrote my book, then we have to be talking about stronger families. And to say, well, healthy families, I think, with all due respect, that can become a kind of dodge, like, oh, we don't want to really say what the research actually shows us, which is that children growing up in a stable two-parent home are, on average, going to do better. And we just don't have any evidence that we know how to compensate for the loss of for the absence of a parent. And by the way, you know, a lot of people will sometimes say, well, oh, look at other countries where they have a much more expansive welfare state, lots of child care and preschool. You know, in those countries, too, children of single mothers don't do as well as the children of married parents. In other words, this is not nobody's found a way for government to compensate for this change that we've been describing over the last 40 years.
And just to clarify, you're not saying that the problem here is the single mother. The problem is the fatherless.
I'm sorry.
The absence of the father.
Well, I would say two things. It's the absence of the father and the instability of the home. You know, probably even more importantly, to be perfectly honest, is the instability of the home.
Jump in real quick, and then we're going to turn to another thing. Go.
I would actually agree with what Kay is saying that we haven't found the magic bullet for equalizing things. In terms of relating us to other countries, I would say that there are still differences between kids raised in single-parent homes and kids raised in two biological parent homes, even in the most generous of welfare states. The differences are smaller than what we see in the United States, and those social safety net programs actually do go some ways in equalizing things. What I would turn to you and say, though, is another question as opposed to, you know, how do we deal with the new norm is, if many women are telling us we want to be married, we want to live the life that you're talking about.
Thank you for the plug.
If many women are saying that's what we want, but they don't seem to be able to get it, let's figure out why it is that they're unable to get it.
That's a good point.
Okay, and so is it blocked economic opportunities? Is it blocked educational opportunities? What is it that's keeping them from attaining the same thing that their more wealthy counterparts are able to attain?
And actually, I have an audience. Can you hear me?
That's
related. What impact does the status of low-income boys and young men in education economic opportunities have on these questions?
Could you repeat that?
What is the impact of the status of low-income boys and young men in education economic opportunities?
Or to kind of pull all this together, to what extent is the desire to be married on the part of many young women thwarted by the lack of good marriageable men,
or men who are locked up and are in jail, which is, I think, another element of this discussion that I think bears some degree of discussion. We still have a huge problem that goes often under discussed by, I think, our political leadership when it comes to overcriminalization, how our criminal justice system treats certain individuals in our society, and what happens when these folks who go through the process are adjudicated, serve their time, and come back into society the fact that our public policy has led to, I think, a problem that just keeps paying itself forward, and that is almost on every application that you would complete for a job, there's going to be a box on that application that says, have you ever been convicted of, and in some cases they're asking the question, have you ever been accused of a felony or misdemeanor? And the moment you check that box, any of us know, particularly in a competitive work environment, that job application is going to go to file 13. And part of, I think, a public policy solution, and this may not be the whole solution, but I've been reading about this idea of drop the box and have been in some discussions with some folks in our private sector about it, which is that on those applications where that question exists, and answering yes or no to that question has no bearing on whether or not you should get the job or should be qualified to do the job, that you would take that question from the application. And basically, anyone who completes it would be compared against everyone else who completes it based on the skill level that they have and what the job is asking for. And then, if you make it to a job interview, it is legal and advisable that you can ask the question in that interview, have you ever been convicted? But the difference is that I can then say, you know what, 15 years ago I made a very bad decision. And I've gotten married, and I've got a family, and I'm working real hard to put us on the right track. That's a different conversation with a potential hirer than me checking a box that completely disqualifies me from a particular position.
Okay, so I love what you're doing here. Okay, because this is what I was hoping we would do tonight, which is that we would identify issues that liberals think a lot about and are very concerned about, which, if addressed, might actually have a benefit to this asteroid that conservatives see facing our culture. And what I'd like to also do is to see if we can find conservative ideas that might be all about the breakdown of the family and how to address that, that might also then have the indirect effect, a positive effect on income inequality and solving other sorts of liberal problems. So we're not asked to accept the other person's asteroid as the primary asteroid, but in solving the problem, we might unintentionally, indirectly end up all kind of working together for different reasons, for different priorities. Right. Yours is a good one. Let me put a couple of others on the table that I'm just curious to hear your reaction to. If, as we, if we accept your argument, Kathy, that there is a problem in terms of changes in the economy, and especially in terms of the erosion of the manufacturing base, stagnation of wages, particularly among males, and a shift away from a lot of good middle-class jobs for men, my question would be, should we have something that I hear occasionally people on the left talk about, greater infrastructure spending to repair bridges and roads and other sorts of jobs that would be largely brawn power jobs, wouldn't be limited exclusively to men, but would be largely held by men who would potentially become more marriageable husbands then to potential women that you encounter that want to marry. Is greater infrastructure spending a good idea?
I mean, I would think in a kind of broad picture speaking, in a short-term scenario, that yes, that would be beneficial in terms of the fact that we need more infrastructure development in a lot of our cities in drastic ways anyway. So these would be public goods being created, good jobs for people to have, there would be more marriageable men available. I think in the long term, though, fundamentally the basis of our economy has shifted, and we are no longer an economy that is based on manufacturing or on labor-type positions. Fundamentally, we're an economy that has technology jobs, education-based jobs, and has service jobs. And we're going to have to figure out a way either to provide education and skills for more people to end up in the higher-end jobs, or we're going to have really hard discussions about how we remunerate the service-level jobs. Yes. We're going to have to bridge the gap so there's not so much of a gap in the standard of living between those with an education and those without. Things like the minimum wage, things that are really sticky to talk about politically.
Right. Okay. None of these are magic bullets. I'm just throwing out, but your point's well taken. Here's another. Should we continue affirmative action on the basis of race but discontinue it on the basis of gender. And the reason I raise this is that if you have the combination, as we do currently, of both race and gender being preferences, employers typically have a great incentive to hire minority women. And it's great when they do, because those minority women get opportunities that many of their foremothers did not have. The problem is that oftentimes the minority men don't get opportunities that might have otherwise come their way.
Right.
And what happens is that you then have, and the data I think showed this in big ways, that you have a lot of kind of well-educated minority women who can't find marriageable men of equal status. So would it be helpful to discontinue affirmative action on the basis of gender, but to continue it on the basis of race?
Like we didn't have enough controversial topics to talk about.
Not fair.
It's just like the soulmate question. I'm looking for one other person who sees the world the way. Because, no, seriously, most people I talk to when it comes to affirmative action, they're like, bad idea, get rid of it, or good idea, let's keep it, never even think about it.
Let me just add a little bit of fuel for Bill's fire here, not without taking a stand. About 57% of college graduates now are women, when you break that down by race, the numbers are even more staggering, and it's something like 62% of black graduates are women. So the problem will be ongoing. Somebody asked before whether the prospects of low-income and minority men isn't part of the problem here, and there's no question that that's true. But the difficult thing for policymakers is to figure out how to get out of this cycle, because what happens is the very men who need higher education are the ones who are then not only growing up in single-parent homes, and, you know, we didn't talk about this, but there's a growing amount of evidence that boys in particular suffer from from family instability, and I think that's borne out in some of the graduation data. So those very boys who we need to get an education to become marriageable men are the ones who are suffering most with the current regime, if that's the proper word. And so it becomes a self-perpetuating process and a kind of scary one that I don't know exactly how to address.
Let me pick up on that and ask, should we be thinking about education reform in much more dramatic ways than we often do today, including not just school choice and giving especially low-income minority parents greater opportunities, but even introducing things like single-sex education where it is desired, so that young boys have opportunities to have male mentors in the classroom, young girls have opportunities to study in classrooms where they're not constantly being interrupted by the boys. Are those ideas that we ought to consider? Because these strike me as being things that would just send certain people on probably both ends, it would just give them the willies. Am I wrong, Ryan?
Yeah. You're not wrong. You're never wrong, man. but... I'm glad I sidestepped the affirmative action one, but I will on the education piece, because maybe this is an idea that I think, regardless of philosophical differences, folks can agree on, and that is that in affirmative action, we've had the elimination of it in state contracting and in higher education in this state since 2000 is, I think, when Governor Bush signed the executive order. And so the reality we've been dealing with is at institutions like the University of Florida and at other state institutions, they've actually seen a decrease in the admittance of minority students, mainly black and brown students. But what we've also seen, and this is, I think, if we were going to go there, this is another piece of the puzzle that has to be figured out, and that is the rising cost of tuition in higher education. So you've got these students who are now spending 6, 7 years trying to get a bachelor's degree because they're working part-time and they're going to school part-time, and then they have a bad semester, and then they're out for a year, and then they're back. And so the supports through Pell Grants and through state-based funding to support the matriculation of these students through higher education, even at institutions like Florida A&M University, a historically black college university who hasn't suffered previously with sort of admissions issues, or Edward Waters University, or Bethune-Cookman College, real serious issues around college affordability. And you know what? It's not just a minority problem. Middle-class parents throughout the state of Florida are experiencing the same cost trauma that I think is leading, in part, not in whole, but in part, to some of this production of good quality role models, but also contributing members of our society who are finding it much more cost prohibitive to make it through higher education in the state.
Very good.
Bill, let's bring this conversation out to the audience for a minute. We have a question or two.
Please, yes.
Okay, well, thank you. Hello. Well, thank you very much for the forum. It's been wonderful to listen in. I just wanted to kind of make a point or two about some of the original Coacher comments there, especially about the Moynihan Report, which we use kind of as a basis to, you know, about the black family, which is a little complicated, the situation there. And the Moynihan Report, you know, he certainly raised a red flag, if you will, about the problems in the black family, but I think his solution was definitely on the economic side. And I think he was talking about the displacement of, or the, you know, the kind of the difficulty of black male employment, and some of that was the, you know, a problem during the Great Migration and things of this nature, and of course slavery. And I think the coach argument kind of got attached to that because of the tangle of, you know, he was trying to, you know, get that across in a pretty complicated way. So, and a lot of people critique that, especially people like Franklin Frazier, E. Franklin Frazier, who's a sociologist who did stuff in this area, and Julius Wilson also, and that's a complicated issue. But especially when it comes to the black middle class, and I know we talk about the caste system, you know, Charles Murray's talked about this in Coming Apart, but there is a lot of instability in the black middle class. Black middle class, generationally, I'm sorry, I'm nervous, they're having a hard time, their generation or two in the middle class, and then they're kind of back from, you know, back to a lower class situation. So that issue is extremely complicated in itself, and I wonder if we have some comments on that. I know, you know, Orlando Patterson has did work on this, and he wrote a pretty provocative essay in The Nation about 4 years ago, and you know, it is an issue. And sorry, I just maybe
Good.
Get that, you know,
yeah.
addressed in some
Thank
fashion.
You, Chris.
I think
yeah.
it's complicated.
Do you want to speak to that, Kay, or anyone
well,
else?
Well, everything that the questioner said is accurate. As far as I know, the Moynihan Report, one of Moynihan's major proposals was to address male unemployment. And, you know, that's part of what we're talking about right here. He was, of course, not dealing with the changes in the economy at quite the same level that we are today.
Well, a lot of the changes in the economy happened after.
Well, that's what I mean.
Moynihan
yes,
wrote
yes,
that things exactly. actually just got worse yes, and worse yes, in terms of opportunities.
Yes. There
yeah,
was
I've got another question over here, and then I have a follow-up to the question before you guys answer it.
Has there been any conclusive research done on the success rate of children that are born to unmarried mothers but who have a supportive extended family willing to take them in and raise the child or children in with the mother in the family in comparison with children that are born to married households?
And my follow-on is actually we have a number of questions that are sort of in that same sphere. Are we defining the healthy family for children to grow up in and be economically successful a little bit narrowly? Are there other formations that, you know, present the same sort of stability? And has that been looked at?
Great questions.
I think the answer is to no. your question, Liz, is no. The research that I'm aware of on grandmothers, which is generally what the extended family is centered on, it does not look particularly promising.
Yeah, I agree. Right? I agree that the research generally shows that two biological parent families are associated with the best outcomes in general, and that certainly living in extended family units can be beneficial for a lot of kids and can help compensate for lack of supervision and a lot of things that go on when you only have one parent. But there tends to still be more instability in those families. And one thing that's very clear in the literature on children and families is that instability is particularly hard on kids. So the more times you change, the more times you move, the more times somebody's in and out of your family, the harder it is. Along those lines, some of the research suggests that even living in a stable single mother family where no one comes in and out can actually be better than transitioning into step families or cohabiting families or those kinds of things. That one parent can be better than two if it leads to more stability.
Let's bring question in from the center real quick.
Hang on just one second, if you would, because I want to pull in Richard on something real quick. We've talked a lot about economics, a lot about politics. I want to get back to this question of cultural values and especially this question of soulmate marriage and whether there is a problem, because you're in the values business. Is part of our problem in all of this unrealistic expectations about spouses or future spouses, and should we seek to disabuse our children of this notion that there is a soulmate out there for them? And then related to that, and anyone else can jump on this if they want, is then the answer arranged marriage? Hey, I'm sorry. I'm a father. I got three kids in their 20s. It was a terrible idea when I was in my 20s. It's looking really good these days. Come on, help me out, Richard.
As the father of four daughters, I might go for that. Well, you got to help me. You have me laughing about
okay.
that.
Soulmates.
Okay. Well, what happens is a lot of people, they fall in love, and the research is you got these electrical feelings, all these chemicals going off in your brain, and it only lasts 18 to 24 months, and then it's gone. So we deal with this with couples all the time when they're in this electric state, electric feelings of love, and it doesn't last. So we talk about, we think it's nice that you have those electric feelings, we think it's wonderful that you're so excited, and that's all you think about, and it's your soulmate, but what are you going to do to have a lasting marriage? Do you want the 5-year plan, or do you want the 50-year plan for your marriage? So we want to show them how to have a life marriage and base it on communication and conflict resolution, and how are we going to get along and how are we going to deal with things that come up in life, because it's a roller coaster. And we tell them that love is a decision, it's not a feeling. The feelings come and go. And if you base your relationship on feelings of soulmate, it's typically not going to last. So that's part of our foundational teaching.
Sorry, Bill.
I'm going to have to go take a cold shower. Help me here.
Okay. I think a lot of people would be shocked that I learned a statistic this week that shocked me. In a square mile area of Tallahassee, there were 380 juvenile arrests of African American children in 18 months. If we're already starting to incarcerate African Americans at a very tender age, no wonder we have 25% of the marriage age men in jail. What is a woman to do?
Please. Perfect. Beautiful. Actually, the statistic is extremely disappointing. One program, well, there are a couple of things that we ought to know about that's happening here in the city of Tallahassee, and we are piloting this really for the rest of the state. We have a program here in the city of Tallahassee that's run at the Palmer Monroe Center, which is our teen center. And a lot of people hear teen center, you think exclusively about recreation. Well, that recreation sits side by side with a program called Restorative Justice. And so for every first-time nonviolent offender who comes into contact with an officer, previously they would be taken down to the courthouse and adjudicated before a judge, and told by that judge that they have committed some crime against the inanimate state of Florida. And that young person likely is not to make much of a connection between the judge or really know anybody who's in the courtroom, or really make the connection between what they've done and how that has impacted and affected the community. And through the Restorative Justice Program, these kids are diverted to a community panel. It consists of Ms. Jackson and Mr. Johnson and the school teacher and the victim, if they so choose. And they sit as a panel with the perpetrator or the person who's committed the harm. And they're explaining to this individual how what they did has negatively impacted them. And they get to make a very realistic and personal connection between really the harm that they've done and how it's impacted larger, greater society and the community. They then get their sentence or penance, or if you will, from this community justice panel, which can include restitution. It automatically includes an 8-week intensive program. They learn what it means to tie a tie, to be a gentleman or a woman, character building classes, value-based classes, as well as real tangible skills. And in cases where restorative justice has been successfully implemented across the country, similar to what we're doing here, previously, cases of recidivism were around 70%, meaning if you commit a crime, 7 times out of 10 times more likely to do it again in graduated phases, so misdemeanor, felony, so on and so forth. And places where this has been implemented successfully, and we're only in our second year of a full program, recidivism rates have dropped as much as 70%.
Can I ask a question?
And so there are solutions that actually can work, but again, it's one of those things that you run the risk of being considered soft on crime, or you're not smart about it. Now, I may approach it from a humanitarian standpoint, but there's a huge economic argument to be made around why it makes sense to do this versus spending $30 million a year in a jail.
Well, I'm all for the program. That sounds like a great program, but I would like to ask if we need fathers more or if we need programs more, because we went into 12 prisons last year in Florida, and overwhelmingly the large percentage of those people that are incarcerated never had a dad that was a responsible father, that was a positive male role model in their lives. So I would like to see us doing something along the lines of responsible fatherhood to teach men how to be fathers. These kids need their dads. They need dad. And a program's okay, but what can we do to get fathers more engaged in the lives of their kids?
I agree. I think first we have to stop the pipeline of moving our future fathers into the criminal justice system. But I agree. I don't disagree with you. I think stable households, good male figures and female figures, and the research has already shown what impact it has. But none of us can stand against it. But these are not monolith issues, and the solutions are not dichotomies. They are and both plus plus.
I would also really like to add that I think one important thing to think about, too, is the influence of inequality in all of this. There have been a lot of studies that show that societies that have high levels of inequality tend to be harsher and more punitive in their criminal justice system. Overall, with a few exceptions, our crime rates are not much different than the crime rates in most of Europe, and yet our incarceration rates are extremely higher. The homicide rate stands out as different. But in terms of pretty much all the other kinds of crimes that you can be convicted of, than most people are convicted of, our rates aren't really that much different. But we punish people longer, and we're more likely to send them to prison as opposed to other kinds of sanctions. And so in that sense, inequality, it's like it pits us against each other, and it makes those that have resources and that are in control like more willing to kind of punish and keep apart those that they see as problematic. And so in that sense, I think addressing inequality can also in turn come back and address some of these other issues.
Kate's got something really short, and then I'm going to direct a little
bit.
Okay,
we got a question here.
Okay, actually, I'm going to make a suggestion. I've got this magic 7-minute thing. Are you all willing to stay 7 minutes late, and we'll have a little lightning round here? You good? And then we'll send you home? Yes? Okay. Yeah, past 7 minutes, I'm sort of done. So anyway, quick question.
Well, not so much as a question, just a comment on the program at Palmer Monroe Team Center. I'm on that panel. I work on that panel. Not only do we give them assignments and work with them, at the end of the program, we come back in a circle and we talk with those children and their parents. They do need additional volunteers to help. So if you're willing to help, please call Rick Davidson at Palmer Monroe Team Center. That program really works.
Excellent.
Or you can contact me if you
question here.
Get that.
I'm worried I'll open a can of worms with this, but something from my generation that is missing, I think, in the conversation about American families is What about the families that can't get married because they're gay or lesbian? And having a stable, the research I know is that gay and lesbian families do really well at raising children. And despite them not being married, how does that affect it?
That was definitely the seven-minute question to ask, wasn't it?
It's funny you ask this because I had been instructed to give a notice at the beginning that we were not going to deal with the gay marriage issue because we were afraid it was going to suck all the oxygen out of the room and we'd never get around to anything else. But we're at the last 7 minutes. You want to, can we?
Can you do it fast?
I just have one quick point to make, which is you're talking about a minuscule number of people in the population, and which is not to tell you what should be done about them or not. I'm just simply saying that the trends we're talking about here are so much larger than what you're describing and have so much more bearing on the total equality and inequality and immobility of this country. So that's the only reason that I think I would say let's not go there.
Aren't we missing a point of potential agreement?
Oh, okay.
If we go there, I don't know.
The only thing I'll say about it is it's an excellent point that our conversation has had a very narrow focus around how we're defining the family. I'm not a researcher, so I don't have the numbers to validate that, but everybody wants to know if their environment in some way is validated in this picture or how it shows up. So I look forward to the conversation that eventually will be facilitated.
We have had forums on the topic and we'll no doubt have future.
And
thank you for scolding us and telling us what we old folks are not doing that young people need to remind us of. That was very good. Okay, please, jump in.
How do we encourage intact families without demonizing single women who bear children?
You got one sentence.
That's a tough one. And I think that's one of the reasons why liberals do sometimes have a problem in kind of taking on these issues and talking bluntly about the fact that the research suggests that there are differences in outcomes for kids based on family, because it feels like blaming the victim, I guess you'd say, in a way, blaming people for their position, when we know sometimes it's not all about choices per se, or it's a lack of good choices.
I think the way to do it is to talk about aspirations and hopes, and as Kathy has been mentioning, the desires of most women are pretty similar. So if we can speak more to trying to satisfy those desires that most women have, then we don't need to work on the demonization part.
And I think single moms have one of the toughest jobs in the world. So I don't ever want anyone to think that we're pouncing on single moms. But I can also tell you, in the work that we've been doing, I've never had a single mom come up to me and say, you know, I can't wait until the day when my child grows up to become a single mom. I just don't see that as an aspiration for single moms. So that doesn't mean we're against single moms. I think we need to support our single moms, but let's point them in a better direction.
The only other point I'd make is that it's as aggressively as we advocate for the strengthening the building of families, we have to advocate across the panoply of social justice issues, I think, that contribute to these kinds of outcomes, from everything from prison reform to educational systems and how we create opportunities to learn for all children. The inputs, there's so many and they're so diverse that I think that impact the outputs. And I think a lot of times we really single in on sort of this one thing as a silver bullet when the solutions are really manifold.
Good.
I think we got one more question over here.
One very quick question, and then we'll go to Bonnie as the last question, unfortunately. Education and SES may be better indicators for children's outcome than marital status. Is this a spurious correlation you're talking about? Is it more about education?
You know, when you control for education, you still find the children of married parents are better off. So it seems to go across the board.
Question. We've discussed lots of different ways of looking at the same general areas of issue. I guess my question in conclusion is to go back to the asteroid theory. And that would be to ask each of you from each of your individual's perspective, if there was one asteroid out there in this entire universe that you would ask us to go home thinking is probably a real one we should be concerned about, what would it be?
Thanks, Steve. Anybody want to jump on that? You've got like 30 seconds to solve the world's problems by going to the very root.
I would say the marriage gap. That is the gap between low-income and high-income families and the resulting inequalities.
I would say the economic gaps between us that I believe then result in all kinds of inequalities, including family inequalities.
Okay. The opportunity gap, creating more opportunities for folks throughout the strand of our society that I think start to get at these larger issues. I think that's at the base of it.
Rich, poor, black, white, educated, uneducated, teaching people how to have healthy relationships.
And I would say that the biggest problem that we face is the lack of time to continue discussions like this that have just been so rich and so fruitful. Before we close, we do have an important announcement that needs to be made by your wife, whom I'd like for you to introduce, not just as your wife, but also for me. At least,
okay.
As your soulmate.
Amen, hallelujah. She's the woman I chased for 6 years without a return phone call, but I got her.
That is his version of the story, and we don't have time to tell the real version. My name is R.J. Gillum. I am married to this wonderful man on stage who I do think is my soulmate, so there you go. I am the Director of Income Strategies at the United Way of the Big Bend, and we are so excited that the Village Square is partnering with us to really continue this conversation. Quick question, what do you all think the poverty rate is in Leon County? Anybody, throw out a number. Close. 26% is what he said. It's actually 23%. How many of y'all think that's too high? State capital, educated city. We have a very unique poverty challenge we'll be doing a week from tonight. I hope to see all of your faces here. We'll be serving dinner at 5, and the challenge begins at 5:30. And we'll go until 7:30. Very stimulating activity where we will role play the scenarios of people in poverty. Grandparents taking care of children because their children are incarcerated. Single mothers, elderly people on a fixed income. The options are various, but our belief is that once we understand the walk of people who are disadvantaged, we can then better help them and as a community come up with solutions so that poverty rate can be lower. So there are flyers on your tables and we have some more at the door. It is free. Please join us next week. Thank you.
Thank you, RJ. And you can come to our website and register if you need to.
Well, Bill, if he gets to introduce my soulmate, Elizabeth Albertson, 25 years this November, love of my life, that's my soulmate.
Thank you all for coming. We'll be doing more of these throughout the year. Please look for notices about future Asteroids gatherings. If you haven't had a chance yet to join our discussion about other topics your mother never said to discuss in public, join us for Faith Food Friday. Thank you.